ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why did Matthew Flinders write such saucy letters to his best friend, George Bass?
Who really chopped off Chopper's ears?
And why did they name a swimming pool after an Australian Prime Minister who drowned?
These are the kind of historical questions we'll be asking on The Dead Can't Sue.
So join me, Alicia Simmons.
And me, Lee Boucher.
Find it by searching for The Dead Can't Sue on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Marr. I'm a man of very few prejudices, but sometimes one or two of them have crept in. And doing this job, fronting Late Night Live, has meant that every now and again I have to face them. And one of those prejudices is thinking that collecting old coins is frankly a bit naff. I mean, it's obviously better than collecting stamps, but, you know, what's the use? Now I discover, A, they have a lot to tell us, and B, Macquarie University has one of the finest collections of old coins in the world. Iron Age, Greek, Roman, Egyptian, that later. Also, authoritarian leaders these days don't need to rely nearly so much on violence and threats of violence to get their way. No, no. What whips and guns worked in the past can more and more be achieved by manipulation, by persuasion. Later in the show, I'll be exploring the dark arts of persuasion in the 21st century with Israeli philosopher Asaf Sharon. But first, to Canberra. Politics at home with old friend Mark Kenny, columnist and the head of the Australian Studies Institute at ANU. Mark, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, David.
Did he have to apologise? I mean, really, it's just a joke.
Yes, look, I think he did. I think it was quite a significant error, actually, to probably go on the program in the first place on this podcast. I understand what the Prime Minister was doing. This is what politicians do these days. They try and reach audiences that aren't otherwise engaged with politics, that aren't watching the news or buying newspapers or even listening to Late Night Live, perish the thought.
Exactly.
And so they seek to find them and reach them kind of on their level, which is has worked for politicians and I think has worked particularly well for Anthony Albanese over a period of time. I mean, he even had his own ale at one stage, which was, you know, that may still be around. In fact,
Did he? You know, I thought Bob Hawke was the only person who had a beer out there.
Well, I think there's Albo's Ale.
All right, okay. No, sure.
We're not meant to be doing advertising on the ABC, and I can't vouch for it because I've never tried it. But he's been good at this kind of, I suppose you'd call it, kind of digital retail politics. But it comes with traps. It comes with risks, albeit relatively minor for the most part. But this was one that was, I think, quite glaring. And the fact that he has issued an unconditional apology, I think, demonstrates that this is now his view as well.
All right. Now, look, we will, of course, have ignited a nationwide controversy by this, but let's let's move on to some things that have a bit more weight to them. Mark,
okay.
You wrote in the Canberra Times this week that you see the dilly-dallying with the One Nation Party as a kind of second squandering by the Liberal Party of its place in politics. Explain.
Yes, well, it's interesting. If you think back to Peter Dutton and what happened, I mean, obviously the first teal that came in was Zali Steggall in the 2019 election when she unseated Tony Abbott. And then there was that, you know, half dozen that came along behind her in the 2022 election, of course, with all essentially taking all of the Liberals' key electoral jewels, you know, the sinecures in the middle of the cities held by former treasurers and prime ministers of great Liberal standing. These were the, you know, the kind of electoral jewels of the Liberal Party. It's very heartland, yep. Almost in a spiritual sense. Dutton did nothing when he took over. Immediately after that electoral result, did nothing to attract the voters who were in those seats and who had left the Liberal Party for people like Zoe Daniel and Monique Ryan and others, they just sort of decided to go down this road of the suburban and regional strategy. The coalition was going to try and flip working class voters much in the same way as they did for, you know, the Conservatives did for Brexit in the UK, and which Trump has successfully done with blue-collar Democrats in the US. It didn't work, right?
No. So we all, complete that's the sort failure.
That's the brief potted history. Scroll forward to now. We've got suddenly this ascendant populist movement on the right, the One Nation, that just sort of embers of which were just faintly glowing for the last 20 years. And suddenly, you know, it's flared up into a fire, electorally speaking. It's shoots up. It's gone ahead of the coalition, easily ahead of the coalition now. It's even been ahead of the Labor Party. And Angus Taylor's response is not to take on One Nation, not to attack it, not to address its abundant racism, its populism, its complete lack of any sort of complexity in its policy positions, or even any obligation to come up with any sort of detail. He has just sort of focused on Labor, talking about the worst government in history, a rotten Labor government, blah, 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 and even talked about, you know, swapping preferences. That's on the table still. There are people in the Liberal Party room who believe they should even reach a coalition-style deal where they don't run against each other in seats, presumably as a sort of a portent of what would happen if they were able to form a majority together. So he's surrendering any sort of moral kind of advantage that the Liberal Party has as a party of, you know, that's been around for 82 years and that has governed for most of those. You know, it's been the most successful party of Australian electoral history. He's surrendering all of that and refusing to take on One Nation. And the difficulty for him is that if the inner city seats have been sort of surrendered and he's not trying to get them back, he thinks, bugger that, just leave them to the independents and Labor and the Greens to fight out. We'll take the ones in the regions and sort of outer suburbs. Well, One Nation's taken them already. Even George Brandis today is saying this strategy of not sort of provoking One Nation, not going after them, you know, it used to be motivated by the idea of not giving Pauline Hanson oxygen, but that debate's over. That debate's well over. You know, Liberals need the oxygen now. They need the exposure themselves, and they need to muscle up. And, of course, Andrew Hastie understands this, the leader in waiting of the Liberal Party. He understands this. But Angus Taylor, he's still sort of kicking gravel around on the driveway of this whole issue and doesn't really seem to know what to do.
Mark, can I put this to you? A two-party political system means that both of those parties straddle a broad range of opinion. They are both broad churches.
Yeah, what they call a big tent party. Yeah.
Big tent party. There have to be big tent parties. Now, Labor is a big tent party. The Liberals were a big tent party. But wasn't the problem that you couldn't keep the tent together once the Nationals and elements of the Liberal Party moved so far right? You could no longer persuade the residents of the wealthy suburbs of Sydney and Adelaide and Melbourne that this was a party that you could respectably vote for.
I think that's right. There's no question that is the process that's gone on, and that sort of whole kind of deal, that compromise that is required, and the compromises that need to exist across that wide spectrum need to be there, and that they've just failed. Those linkages have fallen apart. But the reason for that is a lack of leadership, a lack of moral leadership, a lack of sort of cogent, properly argued, philosophical leadership by the Liberal Party, because that was the grand bargain that existed before. You know, the Liberal Party represented metropolitan voters of a particular type. It represented the centre-right with the emphasis on centre, and Menzies was very clear about this. You know, he was very clear that the Liberal Party had to have a liberal tradition. Others since then, John Howard included, have kind of used the language but drawn the party to the right. But the real crisis they're facing now is that with the existence of One Nation and suddenly this whole, I guess you'd say, this whole sort of zeitgeist globally towards populists, the ability of the Liberal leadership to hold it all together has suddenly failed. Now, the Nats are part of the problem because they're, relatively speaking, a tiny party, and they are, you know, their future is, not at all guaranteed. They may not make it past the next election. On current polling, there's a prospect of them not having any seats. And the Liberal Party is in a state of some sort of existential panic. And this comes about, I think, because they haven't tried to hold the tent together. They haven't made the philosophical arguments. They've just been shifting to the right themselves. They're chasing votes which are not going to come back to them.
Mark, is the problem of losing all of those prosperous seats that the party is more dependent than ever on money from its backers? And those backers want things that most Australians don't. Coal, an end to multicultural immigration, and no accommodation with Indigenous Australia. Now, they are three big issues which the centre of Australian opinion appears to support, but this party, the Liberal Party now, is opposed.
Yeah, I think you'd say that is probably right. That is that criticism is probably true of the entire spectrum of the right at the moment, what the Labor Party, what the Prime Minister refers to as the three right-wing parties. Obviously, when you talk about coal, you talk about mining interests, you talk about opposition to multiculturalism, opposition to the voice, these kinds of things, then names like Gina Reinhardt obviously spring to mind. There's no doubt that that sort of influence is now very strong in the coalition, and the Liberal Party seems to have lost its connection, even with some of the other what you might call metropolitan or retail corporations. So we saw, for example, Peter Dutton in his term as opposition leader, you know, sort of going to war with I think it was Woolworths at one stage because of what was essentially a sort of a culture war jibe about Australia Day flags and other merchandise.
Yes.
And, of course, Dutton was very strong on saying, we are the working class party. We represent the workers of Australia. We're not the party of big business, which is not the Liberal Party of the past, of course. It's quite a strong move, really, a strong move which took them into further weakness, if I can put it like that.
But at the same time, this party has put in place a president who the other day gave a speech in London perfectly seriously in which he said that this thing called the left establishment, ashamed of Indigenous dispossession, wanted to punish Australia by allowing multicultural immigration into the country, and particularly punish us because that was going to extinguish the core culture of the nation. Judeo-Christian, Anglo-Celtic core foundational ethos of Australia, and the worst migrants they were bringing in, not by accident but by plan, were the Muslims, and the Muslims will make pluralist democracy unworkable in this country. Now that, if I can venture an opinion, is ratbag. It's ratbag. And he's the president of the Liberal Party.
Yes, that's right. And these are views that he did not express in those blunt terms when he was Prime Minister of the country. Now, the Liberal Party is going through a lot of angst about this internally. They're not talking about it much. They're trying to pretend everything is normal. But they have a former Prime Minister who is president who has vectored to the right quite considerably since leaving Parliament in the sort of unceremonious way that he did, the aforementioned Zali Steggall defeating him. Who's gone through what you might call the radicalization process of frequent appearances on Sky After Dark and the kind of echo chamber that exists there. And, of course, you've got Pauline Hanson that we've been talking about as well, and you've got the trends that have been happening overseas. And so there's this whole kind of atmosphere now of kind of radical right, clear language, and it's being used, things are being said now that would never have been uttered by Tony Abbott when he was Prime Minister and when he was in the decision-making process. Now he's president. Poor old Angus Taylor is there, doesn't know whether to fight One Nation or not. All he, you know, just comes up with the sort of old lines about taking on Labor. But his real existential fight is there. And they're all trying to insist that, well, the president, it's purely a kind of a chairing role of the organisational side of the party. It doesn't make policy and everything else. Well, tell it to Tony Abbott. Everything he says is extremely newsworthy because he's a former prime minister. He's now basically manipulating, a bit like Pauline Hanson is manipulating the whole political right, you know, from that right flank, you'd probably say that Tony Abbott is now exercising undue influence on the Liberal Party from that supposedly organisational or titular position as president. I mean, why did he want the job? Well, he wanted the job to do the kinds of things he's doing now and making these speeches. And he says things like, countries that are ashamed of themselves, their past, for them it's hard to be strong and self-confident. Well, maybe it's hard for them to be strong and self-confident because they can't face up to the truth about the origins of their country. They won't face up to. I mean, a lot of his arguments seem to me to have their sort of weakness built right into them. But
it's strange because, you know, after that spray about Muslims and people who don't share the Anglo-Celtic culture, he delivered an aria about the beauties of immigration. It's very strange. But, Mark, I'm exhausted by laying out my own prejudices here from beginning to end. You've been lucky to get a word in edgewise, as far as I'm concerned. Thank you so much for joining us on the show, Professor Mark Kenny from the Australian Studies Institute at ANU.
It's a great pleasure, David. Thank you.
Coming up, the dark arts of manipulation. Until things go terribly wrong, totalitarian regimes are popular. Dangerous, of course, but surprisingly popular. And they stay that way these days, according to philosophers Asaf Sharon and Avishai Margalit, less by violence than manipulation. These days, they write, an onslaught against a free society advances not in columns of revolutionary guards and brown shirts, but through video clips and memes. The hard power of coercion has been widely supplanted by the soft, subversive power of manipulation. Harvard University Press has just published their book, Captive Minds, A Study of Manipulation. And Asaf Sharon joins me now from Vienna. He is Professor of Philosophy at Tel Aviv University. Asaf, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
You actually date this shift from violence to manipulation to the second half of the 20th century. What happened then to make this change?
Well I think the trauma of the first half of the 20th century and the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century has a lot to do with it. Of course, this shift is not total. It's a shift of emphasis. So if you think about the 19th century, if you think about the first half of the 20th century in most of the world and the latter in the non-democratic parts of the world, it's pretty clear that these regimes, the totalitarian regimes, dictatorial regimes, were fundamentally undergirded by a system of violence, of brutality, and of intimidation. So you talk about secret police, about the Gulag system. And what we see over the second half of the 20th century, culminating in the fall of the Iron Curtain, is a shift away from naked brutality, naked force as a means of government or as the principal means of government. Of course, it's always there. But even if you compare someone like, say, Vladimir Putin to Stalin, you can see the shift, right? For Stalin, the NKVD, the police force, and the Gulag system were highly instrumental in the maintenance of power and the exercise of power. Where for someone like Putin, of course, you know, every once in a while you need to eliminate some yes. a nosy journalist or a troublesome dissident. But by and large, you enjoy the support of the majority of the population. So that means managing public opinion.
Now, why has this become to be so powerful that it relegates violence as a tool of control? How has this happened?
Well, I think so we talked about the negative, right? The shift away from naked violence, which became anathema to too many people. And also, as previous, you know, if you think about someone like Machiavelli even, you know, Machiavelli says you need to be fearful, right? Or to be feared by people if you really want to control them. But fear is not enough. You also need to be loved. Because no matter how good the fortress is, no fortress can withstand the hatred of your people. So you need to play this game between violence and manipulation. What happens during the 20th century, besides this shift away from naked violence, is the instruments of manipulation have become vastly more powerful. The principles are the same, the concept is the same, but the instruments, especially with the rise of computers, of the internet, now with AI, the ability to target people in very sophisticated and systematic ways has simply exploded. So this makes manipulation much more handy.
But manipulation itself, as you were saying a moment ago, kind of is the same. Tools are different, but what's being done here, tried here, is the same. And I'm wondering how you see people making themselves vulnerable to manipulation.
Right. So this is one of the key questions we try to explore in the book, because unlike coercion or violence, manipulation operates through the capacities, the inclinations of their target. So your question is very adequate. How do people make themselves vulnerable to manipulation? And the answer that we come up with is we all have these natural inclinations or mental vulnerabilities, whether it is fear, whether it is vanity, whether it is our desire to be loved or our desire to be entertained. All of these create vulnerabilities that clever manipulators know how to tap into. Now, there's a sophisticated question here of how this responsibility is to be parsed out between manipulator and manipulated.
Yes.
But obviously, with violence, you know, you're simply a passive subject. In manipulation, you are partially an actor. You are a participant. Whether this participation makes you culpable or not, I think, depends on circumstances. But manipulation is more about harnessing people's capacities, their mental states, to the desires of the manipulator, not just crushing them as violence, brutality, or coercion does.
Do you think we underestimate the extent to which people don't want to know?
I do. I think oftentimes there is this this optimistic fantasy that if only the truth was available, right? So you hear this, there's a lot of energy put into fact-checking and putting out the truth as if the only barrier is the absence of truth in the public sphere. But if you study the way that misinformation, that conspiracy theories, demagogy, propaganda, that all these mechanisms of manipulation work, what you find is It's not that the truth is absent. It's that the truth is unpleasant. The truth is unflattering. So people have a kind of deep-seated desire, inclination, urge not to know it. Think about things like that have been well studied and well documented, like confirmation bias, right? We all suffer a confirmation bias because we'd rather have our views confirmed.
Yes.
So the absence of truth is not the whole story. Obviously, fact-checking is important. Getting the truth out there as journalists like yourself do is important, but it's not the whole story. We also need to come up with ways to combat the very seductive appeal of disinformation, of conspiracy theories, etc.
Why are they so seductive? Is it because they play to our needs, play to what we already believe? Or is it something deeper than that, something more vain?
I think it's both. Sometimes they simply play into what we believe and we all like to feel, you know, justified and confirmed. But one of the key mechanisms that we explore is the mechanism of rationalization. So, you know, we like to think of ourselves as rational beings, and philosophers definitely like to think about human beings as rational animals. But more often, we rationalize, which is to say, we try to seek out the most appealing or the explanation that will make what we do or what we believe seen in the best of light. And so, you know, just to give a kind of mundane, everyday example, you know, you go to the supermarket, the cashier gives you more change than you are owed. you step outside, you realize you have more money, but you really don't want to give it back. So you say, you make up justifications, right? You say things like, oh, it's a big chain. It doesn't make a difference to them. Or probably some other time they took more than they were owed, so it balances out. You make up these justifications to feel warranted in what you, in a way, deep down know was not the right thing to do. That is rationalization. And we all suffer from it, right? This is not about some other people. And tapping into people's rationalization is a very powerful mechanism. When you think about something like conspiracy theories quite often are rationalizations that are being offered to people by other people in order to basically court them into a worldview that is unverified. It's not based on any evidence or facts. Yeah. But it is much more congenial to what they already believe or to the actions that they have undertaken or the commitments they have done. So instead of admitting that you were duped, you can say, oh no, I was right all along. There's just this conspiracy that makes things go awry.
Do you think there has to be a grain of truth, at least in conspiracy theories, before they work?
It's always more effective if there's a grain of truth. And if you study conspiracy theories, you quickly find that they are not opposed or resistant to facts. In fact, many times, conspiracy theorists are hoarders of facts, right? It's like you see a conspiracy theory track. There's lots of facts that they list more and more and more. It's about the way they put them together or the facts that don't get mentioned or the absence of evidence for some of these facts. So the more you can ground a conspiracy theory in actual truth that people are familiar with, and then on the top of that, build an explanation that is unfounded, that is unsupported by evidence, but sounds credible or rationalizes what people are already inclined to believe, the more powerful this will be.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am talking to the philosopher Asaf Sharon about his book that he has co-written with Avisai Margalit, Captive Minds, A Study of Manipulation. Asaf, I wonder whether another way in which we're vulnerable to manipulation is because we like trusting people. We like the feeling of trust, and it's hard to dislodge.
Yes, that brings up an important point. So previous philosophers have written about the flee from freedom, the escape from freedom, this notion that it's easier to rely on authorities, on outside forces to tell us what to do, what is right, what is wrong. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is that trust is a very elusive concept. Sometimes it's too easily given, but sometimes it's unwarrantedly withheld. Especially when it comes to trust in institutions. So we, in a democracy, we must rely on institutions, not just, you know, for delivering us clean water or transportation, but also for things like knowing what the world is like, for information. Mm-hmm. So we have this idea that, you know, we know things by virtue of experience, our senses. And philosophers have written a lot about, you know, how the senses deliver truths about the world. In fact, most of what we believe or know about the world comes from a different source, namely testimony, right? Most of what we know, we either learned from our parents as children, from our teachers, or from books that we read, from the television, and so on. So relying on other epistemic sources, sources of knowledge, is crucially important. And these sources of knowledge are institutionalized. They're institutionalized in universities, in books, encyclopedias, peer-reviewed journals, et cetera, et cetera. What happens when trust in these institutions is undermined? And we saw this, I think, very clearly during the COVID crisis, where many people lost faith in the medical institutions in their countries, sometimes with justification, but many times without it, on the basis of conspiracy theories or other people manipulating them into suspicion. And for a sophisticated modern society, lacking trust in institutions is the preamble to crisis.
And a preamble to manipulation.
Of course, of course.
There's a technique of manipulation which is now sort of it comes up all the time in discussions about Trump and his regime. No, I'm sorry, his administration. And that is the notion of flooding the zone with shit. Now, I love the idea, and I feel it really works, but I'm wondering if you've looked at the way in which this does work, where you simply overwhelm people with nonsense, and somehow it works to manipulate them.
Right. So this notion of flooding the zone with shit, I believe it comes from Steve Bannon, his former advisor. And let me back up one bit. When philosophers have written about manipulation, not a lot, but when they do, they often regard it as a kind of irrational influence. So when you manipulate someone, instead of offering them reasons they can consider and weigh, what you're doing is, as sometimes put, playing on their emotions or something of the sort. So it's an irrational influence. In fact, we don't believe that is true. We think that a lot of manipulation works by exactly appealing to people's cognitive abilities, that is, offering them reasons, giving them a story. Conspiracy theories are case in point. Flooding the zone with shit, I think, is another. Because what is this shit that Steve Bannon was talking about? It wasn't saying things that have no meaning, right? One sense of bullshit, the philosopher Harry Frankfurt very famously wrote this article on bullshit, where he talks about something that is has no regard for truth. Other philosophers have talked about bullshit as having no regard for sense. So just meaningless propositions that seem like they have meaning, but they actually don't. That is not Steve Bannon's bullshit. Steve Bannon's bullshit has to do with many, many propositions, ideas, stories, narratives that don't really add up to anything specific. They're not meaningless, right? They say things that are very coherent. They don't add up to anything. They have no relation necessarily to truth or to the evidence available to us, but they create a sense in which truth is no longer attainable. The very idea that we should, you know, sift through the evidence and try to sort out facts from fiction, truth from falsity, that becomes inaccessible. It becomes almost inconceivable because there is just so much out there. And what we find, I think, often just in casual conversation, you hear people saying, oh, I don't believe anyone anymore, right? Yes. So if I can get you to believe my narrative because I failed in a kind of evident way, what I might do is get you to despair on sifting between truth and falsity. And I can do that by simply overwhelming you, inundating you with various tales, various narratives, various facts or counterfacts, to the point that you just say, you know, you throw your hands up in the air and you say, oh, who knows? And what happens at that point? If figuring out truth from falsity is no longer an option, well, you just lean back and rely on conventional wisdom, on what is more comfortable, on what makes you feel better, or what entertains you. And then people like Steve Bannon and his champion Trump, they win.
Yes. Asaf, I see on television, I read in newspapers, accounts of Israelis who appear to be utterly sincere when they say that no babies starved in Gaza, that nothing unnecessary was done in Gaza. They absolutely reject any notion of cruelty on behalf of the Israeli armed forces. And yet I see evidence which suggests that all of those propositions are to some extent true. And I'm wondering how a people can reach a conclusion which appears, certainly from a distance, to be so at odds with the evidence?
That's a fantastic and, for me, painful question. Since October 7th, I've seen in my country this very tragic state where an entire nation has basically detached itself partially from its own reality. And the facts that you mentioned, like the starvation in Gaza, like the massacre of civilians in Gaza. And, you know, even if we set aside these horrors, these moral horrors, just the mere fact that we are failing, both in Gaza, in Lebanon, and also in Iran, Israelis have become obtuse. They've become detached from these facts, which is really interesting because, you know, Israel is I'm not sure if you can call it a functioning democracy, but it is a democracy to the extent that we have a free press.
Yes.
There is no central censor that tells the newscasters what they can and cannot say. Everybody has cable TV. They can turn on CNN or BBC or your ABC. And nevertheless, the vast majority of my countrymen and women don't really know what is happening miles away from their homes in Gaza. And the reason for that is partially to do with manipulation and partially to do with what my friend Ayala Paniewski in a recent book called The New Censorship describes very well about how news organizations make themselves, censor themselves, trying to court some kind of imagined public opinion. And of course, this public opinion itself is the outcome of manipulation. So one thing that one of the great manipulators of my country, a man by the name of Benjamin Netanyahu, managed to do after October 7th is to transform the shock and the terror that was experienced by the nation into basically a hatred and revenge towards the Palestinians, which was easy to do given the circumstances, but it was actually... this manipulative move was a diversion tactic. Instead of people looking at him and his own failure, we became focused on taking revenge on Palestinians. And the other part of it is lying to ourselves and not allowing ourselves to see what we have done to the people of Gaza. So this is a very sad example of how mass manipulation within what is by and large an open society operates these days.
Asaf, you've argued about this shift from violence to manipulation, but isn't part of what makes us vulnerable to manipulation fear? And the fear of Israelis of Palestinian revenge, of Palestinian violence, that must make people vulnerable.
Absolutely. As I said in our account, manipulation is basically the exploitation of mental vulnerabilities to seize control over other people. And fear is one of the great vulnerabilities, not the only one, but it's one of the great vulnerabilities of people, especially of multiple people. And as I said, I think the terror that Israelis experienced on October 7th was very genuine, very real, and was well warranted. The question is, what happens with it? How does it function? What does the political leadership do with this fear? I mean, one thing they could do is say, look, we really need to come to terms with this situation. We need to resolve it. We need to seek peace, right? That is another way of addressing fear. After the Intifada, the first Intifada in the late 80s, some people in Israel reacted as Netanyahu did and tried to garner this kind of militant reaction. But others, like Yitzhak Rabin, the late prime minister, they said the opposite. They said, look, there's a problem here. Fear is justified, so we need to change the circumstances and we need to seek some kind of political resolution. That was a bold, courageous thing to do. We know how it ended. Sadly, after October 7th, nobody was willing to do that. And the fear, genuine fear, justified fear, was exploited in a way that not only was a horror towards Palestinians, but also undermined Israelis' own security. So I think now, 2.5 years later, Israelis should be more afraid, and I think many of them are more afraid than they were back then.
And from the beginning of time, for society after society, isn't one of the vulnerabilities we suffer patriotism?
Well, patriotism, just like fear, it can be good, it can be bad. Right. If you're walking in the jungle and you see a lion and you're afraid, then you run away. That's probably a good thing. And I think it's the same with patriotism. If patriotism is to mean loyalty to your own, if it is to mean solidarity with your community, patriotism can be a great thing. If it pushes us to sacrifice our own interests sometimes for the greater good, that can be a good thing. But when patriotism is inflated, when it is manipulated, when it is exploited in order to get people to harm others unjustifiably, in order to uphold the power of people who should not be in power, I mean, that's when patriotism becomes a very dangerous weapon. And as we've seen throughout history, it often does get exploited in this way. That's why we have to be constantly vigilant.
Asaf, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking to Asaf Sharon, Professor of Philosophy at Tel Aviv University and co-author with Avishai Margalit of Captive Minds, A Study of Manipulation. It's published by Harvard University Press. Coming up, a hoard of gold and silver. Out at Macquarie University in the suburbs of Sydney is a hoard of ancient coins, one of the finest collections in the world, 7,000 or so of them, of gold and silver and copper from the Iron Age and the empires of the Persians, the Sassanids, the Romans and beyond. They're held in the Australian Centre for Ancient Numismatic Studies, which has recently appointed a new director, Peter Edwall, Professor of History and Archaeology at the University, who has big plans for opening the collection to the world. After Trump began imposing tariffs last year, Peter was on the show talking about Rome's own disastrous attempts to impose tariffs on the empire. And Trump has a bit part to play in this story too. Welcome, Peter, back to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David. Great to be talking to you again.
Peter, how come Macquarie has this hoard?
Well, we're very fortunate, David, in that now, a little over 25 years ago, a very generous donor who had collected this large collection of ancient coins over quite a long period of time decided in his very generous way, he and his wife, this man's name is Bill Gale and his wife's name is Janet, that they would donate their entire collection, Bill's entire collection of ancient coins to the university, along with very generous amount of money to establish the centre, and it's been a really wonderful part of our enterprise now for, just over a quarter of a century.
So students come to Macquarie to study old coins.
Yes, and well, we have international scholars come to visit us at the centre to work on the coins and with the wonderful library that we have, and we have all sorts of people come, but one of the really wonderful things about this is just the level of student engagement. And we get a lot of interest from the students, and they become very dedicated to this, very interested in this, and some have gone on actually to glittering careers in numismatics and in other areas as well.
What grabs the interest of anybody in these coins?
I think it's actually being able to hold them. I think it's working with them directly. You know, it's that old thing, you know, that we're talking here about. A large part of the collection is 2,500 years old, and they can hold these in the palms of their hands and really study them in detail and get that sense of what it's like to sort of commune with the distant past in a rather direct way. And they're shiny, they're beautifully made, some of them, quite a lot of them. And so I think that there's a lot that potentially appeals to people about them.
Metal detectors on the doors, Peter?
Oh, we have very good security. We have it's one of the highest security areas of the university. It has to be. The university has done a very good job of making sure that we've got all of that in place.
I'm sure it's not needed. Now, Peter, my curiosity in old coins has only just been sparked. I want to ask some basic questions.
Sure.
When those coins were being used, how were they valued? Were they valued because of the value of the metal in them?
It's usually that, yes. I mean, mostly when we're talking about ancient coinage, it's about the actual precious metal content and the weight of that metal content. So in terms of silver coins and gold coins, weight was everything, and consistency was everything, and they went to a lot of trouble to get that right, because people who were using these coins seem to be keenly aware of when there are changes, when the weights drop, or even particularly when the precious metal content drops as well. So there are some coins that do have sort of denominational values on them, but mostly it's about the precious metal content.
So it didn't matter what market it was in, it didn't matter what country it was in. This little object weighed so many grams, and therefore it was worth that.
Well, it's interesting actually, because when we look at particular the particular types of coins, so we look at the Athenian tetradrachm, for example, or later the Roman denarius, and we can even go up into the Abbasid period, the Abbasid silver dram. These coins could be used right across the Eurasian continent, as it were, because there was this recognition of their very high silver content, the very high gold content, and that that was currency really wherever it went. I mean, mostly it is about using it in the entity in which it was minted. But gold coins, Roman gold coins, for example, have been found as far away as Vietnam. Silver coins, Roman silver coins in India, and Athenian tetradrachms were used widely throughout the Arabian Peninsula back in the 5th and 4th centuries BC. So, yeah, it works a little, I suppose, how you might think of a currency like the US dollar, for example, where it can be used in many, many countries still throughout the world.
When did people start putting faces on coins?
Now, that's a good question, because faces really start appearing on coins fairly early. I mean, so if you think about the coinage of Alexander the Great, for example, so if we're talking here to getting towards the end of the 4th century BC, we have lots of coinage with Alexander's face on them, but earlier than that too. So I know our earliest coinage really dates back to the earliest we can date it to seems to be around the sort of the later part of the 7th into the 6th centuries BC. And that's here we're talking about Lydian coinage from Asia, Minor or modern Turkey.
And made by a king we still remember.
Well, Croesus was, yes. Croesus certainly was a king that is still part of the common parlance, isn't as rich as Croesus. We still hear that term. And these individuals were having their faces on coins from quite an early stage.
And what was the point of that? Was it simply to advertise their power, or did it make the coin genuine in some way?
It's a good question, and I think it's a bit of both. I think it's partly about advertising their power and giving them legitimacy, but it's also giving authority to the coin itself and giving confidence to the use of that coinage. And I guess we can think about that even in the way that we don't use modern coins much anymore, certainly not in Australia, but we still there's an idea of the authority being stamped on it, and it gives it that it gives the coin legitimacy, but it adds legitimacy to the ruler. So I think it's going a little bit both ways.
Do we have coins in circulation with King Charles on them yet?
Yes, I think we do. I use coins so infrequently that I don't think I've actually had one pass through my hands, but I'm pretty sure that we do have Charles III coinage in circulation.
Was the decision taken in the United States not to allow a leader's face on coins and notes? Was that because they had that action had such a kind of imperial taint?
I think so. I think it's certainly part of that. I mean, this goes back to the 1860s. The rules in relation to this in having a living person on a coin, and so it's been an idea in the US now for a very long period of time that actually doesn't happen. And I think it may be connected to that idea that there's an uneasiness about this idea of, well, we've seen it in terms of, say, the No Kings rallies, haven't we? Against Trump, and the idea that Trump is looking more and more like a king that, of course, the Americans rejected back in the 1770s, 1780s. And of course, that's exactly what the Romans did when they rejected kings centuries before.
But Caesar, of course, had his face on a coin before he... Oh, I suppose he was by that time calling himself... What did he call himself? Dictator?
He'd be... Well, at this stage, he's actually been made dictator for life. So in many senses, that while he studiously avoided the term king, although there's a little bit in the sources that suggest he might have been even going to take that title. I don't think he would have, but... The Romans had so roundly rejected the idea of kings back when they kicked their kings out at the end of the 6th century BC. But Caesar, by the time we get to his period of immense power, which here we're talking in the 50s and 40s BC, had taken on all sorts of titles that weren't really meant to be taken on under the rules of the Republic. And one of them was the dictatorship for life. You were only meant to serve as dictator for 6 months. But at the time that he took this title on, his face starts appearing on coins. And that's really, I mean, we do get some idea that Sulla, another very powerful figure earlier in the first century BC, had had put some sort of image of himself on coins. But with Caesar, it's clearly Caesar. And that's a big move, because this had been something that the Romans had really avoided in the Republic up to this time.
And it's obviously because of Donald Trump's granular knowledge of ancient history that he wants to put his own face on the $250 bill and coins as well. But it's against the law, yet he still wants to do it.
Oh, yes. Well, the interesting thing here is, and maybe it works a little in the way that it did in the Republic, is that in relation to Caesar, is that we don't get a sense that Caesar sort of says directly, put my head on a coin. And in this case, it's the US Treasury sort of leading the way and knowing that that's going to be a popular thing to do, certainly in the eyes of Donald Trump. But at the moment, I mean, I'm sure whatever's going on behind the scenes looks something considerably different. But at least publicly, there's this kind of bit of a dance whereby it's not Trump directly saying, hey, you need to do this, but certainly the Treasury's coming up with the idea and Trump's very happy about it. So
yeah, but then the great thing is, of course, nobody uses coins anymore. Peter, yes. When did coins begin to be dated?
Well, we date them in sort of different ways to maybe perhaps how we date modern coins, where you've actually got the actual year on them. If we look, say, at Roman coinage, for example, we can often date it based on the imperial titulature, so the name of the emperor and how that changes over time. And often the emperors held consulships and tribunates and things like that, and we can date them on the basis of the way that they change. And there's also just a bit of guesswork too, where you don't have that level of detail. Then there's a bit of guesswork on how you might date coins, be they Roman or Greek or any other type for that matter.
How are you going to open this to the world? What are your plans here?
Well, I'm very fortunate in that the previous director who was director of the centre, this is Ken Sheedy, he was director of the centre from its opening for 25 years, had started this really wonderful digitisation project, and that's been going now for the last 18 months, 2 years, whereby very high-quality images have been taken, and we have one of our former students, Emily Salhub, has been working really hard on this and has developed absolutely wonderful skills in digital photography. And we're now at the point where almost the entire collection has been photographed at a very high level, and progressively it's being made available to the world through the Macquarie University portal that these coins can be accessed on. And that will now, once the whole project's finished, it will allow us then to be able to link in to other databases, very renowned databases overseas, so that we can be very much a part of that world too.
And we'll put the link up on our website. But Peter, you won't be able to hold them. What's the coin?
No.
What is the coin, the holding of which most excites you?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we've got some really grand pieces. We've actually just acquired last year a medallion of the Emperor Commodus, and people will be aware of Commodus from the whole Gladiator movie phenomenon. But sometimes I think it's also the smaller coins, the little ones, the ones that you can see have been used over quite long periods of time and have been through a process of exchange over who knows how many years, and you get that sense of just what an incredibly interesting life that this coin must have had. And sometimes it's those ones that I'm sort of probably drawn to as well.
Peter, thanks for joining us again on the show.
No, thanks, David. Pleasure.
I've been talking to Peter Edwell, Associate Professor at Macquarie University and the new Director of the Australian Centre for Ancient Numismatic Studies. That's the show. On our next, as the right to life, liberty and chasing happiness is being celebrated across America with speeches and fireworks, the Supreme Court of India has identified a more humble but no less fundamental one, the right to safe footpaths. But where will the hawkers go?
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.